From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Few have monitored the country's financial pulse as closely as David Walker, U.S. Comptroller General. And David Walker is profoundly alarmed. When the White House this month touted good new budget numbers, Walker's response was, "Don't be deceived." U.S. debt obligations, he estimates, have reached $45 trillion, or $150,000 of debt for every American man, woman, and child. To balance the budget in 2040, he says, when today's newborns are in family-raising adulthood, the U.S. government will need to cut spending by as much as 60% or raise taxes by 250%. A terrible national reckoning is coming, Walker warns, and it's not being stopped. The biggest threat to America right now, he says, is the U.S. government's own fiscal irresponsibility. Tonight on Point, America's top watchdog, David Walker, says the country's going broke, and a Bush administration veteran pushes back. You can join the conversation. Is America in denial? Is it heading toward calamity? Or is that just Chicken Little talking? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Philip Swagel, Chief of Staff at the Council of Economic Advisers under George W. Bush until February this year. But first, joining me now from Washington is U.S. Comptroller General David Walker at the Government Accountability Office, a 3,200-employee government body that monitors all federal programs. He was appointed by President Clinton for a 15-year term in 1998. Good evening and welcome, David Walker.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thanks very much for joining us. David Walker, I know that you are famously not in the business of raising false alarms, or you like to say of using inflammatory language, but you know people begin to glaze over quickly, so I wish you would lay out the stakes for us right at the top here. We're going to get into a lot of details, but what is at stake in this whole body of concern that you're raising over the U.S. deficit, over the U.S. fiscal situation?
Our country faces three deficits at the present time: a budget deficit, a balance of payments deficit, and a savings deficit. The combined effect of these three deficits represents a much greater threat to the future of our country, our children, and our grandchildren than any other country or any terrorist group. Our situation may be getting better in the short term, but we face large and growing structural deficits due primarily to known demographic trends and rising health care costs that are getting worse every day, and it's time that we started doing something about it.
Mr. Walker, put the potential consequences of that threat in as real terms as you can for us. We talk about, you know, structural problems, and again, it can be, and we'll look at those tonight, but it can be kind of eye glazing again. The threat you're describing could produce what kind of consequences?
Well, it depends. It depends upon whether or not we get serious soon and start to take steps to avoid what otherwise could be a very adverse outcome. You mentioned a couple of possibilities, that if we just ended up maintaining our period of denial and going on our present path, then we could face huge increases in tax burdens in the future. That would end up obviously having a significant adverse effect on economic growth. It would obviously have an adverse effect on disposable income, and it would threaten our long-standing history of being able to pass on to our children and grandchildren more opportunity and a higher standard of living than has been the case for us and our predecessors.
And you're saying if we're not passing on that higher standard of living, are you talking about the risk of a lower standard of living, of Americans taking some kind of real economic whack that would send us back years, a kind of a new depression, or is that too extreme?
Many types of possibilities could exist. I mean, we could end up having hyperinflation. We could end up having, much slower economic growth. I think the fact of the matter is that we have the ability to mend our ways. We have the ability to put ourselves in a much more prudent path for the future, but we haven't started doing it yet, and it's important that we do soon.
President Bush and the White House pointed out recently that the tax revenues are coming in much ahead of expectation this year so far, and that the federal budget projection for this year, instead of being $420 billion or something like that, is only going to be $333 billion, only $333 billion, but that's a lot less than was expected. President Bush says this is good news. It shows we're doing the right things. We've got the right policy. What do you say?
Well, the first thing I think you have to acknowledge is lower short-term deficits are obviously better than higher short-term deficits. Mm-hmm. But we need to put things in perspective. That $333 billion number is unacceptably high, and it's hard to explain. We haven't been in a recession since November of 2001. Mm-hmm. We had the strongest GDP growth rate or economic growth rate of any industrialized nation last year. Only about $100 billion of that $333 billion has anything to do with the global war against terrorism and incremental homeland security cost. And yet, in reality, our deficit's not really $333 billion because we're spending every dime of the Social Security surplus on other government expenditures, and so it's really going to be in excess of $500 billion.
You mean if, when you include what you and I and every other working American are shipping in every week or month in our, from our paychecks in terms of Social Security contributions? That's all
that's
being
correct.
Spent.
Every dime of that is being spent on other government operations. It's being replaced with a government bond, which is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. It's guaranteed as to principal and interest. It has legal, political, and moral significance. It has no economic significance whatsoever. And so we're basically increasing the burden on our children and our grandchildren and future generations of Americans every day.
What happened to the surplus that we had in 2000 at the end of Bill Clinton's term? President Bush was talking about in February 2001, again before 9/11, but he was saying he foresaw a $5.6 trillion surplus over the next 10 years. Instead, we've got these huge deficits we're talking about. What happened to those projections? Were they just wrong?
Well, several things, Tom. One, they were projections, and I underline that word projections. They're only as good as the assumptions that underlie them.
But the surplus was real, was it not, in 2000?
Well, that's correct, and I think this is important, Tom. We had an actual short-term surplus. At the time that people were talking about $5.6 trillion 10-year projected surpluses, mm-hmm. number one, they were projected. And number two, they were temporary. Even back then, we knew that we were going to face large and growing structural deficits due to known demographic trends and rising health care costs. Mm-hmm. We did not take the prudent course, and now our short-term surpluses have turned into short-term deficits. Our long-term deficits are much greater than they were back then, and the demographic tidal wave or tsunami of the retirement of the baby boom generation, my generation, is closer to becoming a reality.
Now, President Bush and his advisors say that the tax cuts that he brought are working. Thank heavens for them. If it weren't for these tax cuts, we'd be in much worse shape now. What do you say to that, David Walker?
I haven't seen any empirical evidence to support that. The fact of the matter is there are three reasons why we are where we are. Number one, we've been increasing spending on a much more rapid pace than historically has been the case for the last 40 years, and it's not all for homeland security and national defense. Secondly, entitlement spending is increasing at a very rapid pace, and entitlement reform is essential. And thirdly, the amount of revenues that we're receiving as a percentage of the economy is low by historical standards. And so it's a combination of those three things that cause us to be where we are. Basically, we have revenues equal to about 16.5% of our economy, but we're spending at about 20% of our economy, and that's going to get a lot worse when the retirement of the baby boom generation hits.
So when President Bush says, as he did just a few days ago, our tax relief plan, our pro-growth policies are working, you say, no, they're not, or yes, but not they're not doing enough?
What I'm saying is that's an unproven assertion. There is not empirical data to say that they are. But more importantly, the fact that we have a $333 billion unified deficit, a $500-plus billion on-budget deficit, is fundamentally imprudent.
David Walker, you've been in Washington for a while now, and I should ask you about your politics. What are you? You were appointed by Bill Clinton. Are you a liberal Democrat? Are you a Joe Lieberman guy? Are you a closet Republican? What are your politics?
I'm an independent. I started out in life as a conservative Democrat. I became a moderate Republican back in 1976. I became an independent in 1997. And what I try very diligently to do is to conduct myself in a professional, objective, fact-based, nonpartisan, and non-ideological fashion. Mm-hmm. I was a presidential appointee of Ronald Reagan. I was a presidential appointee of George Herbert Walker Bush. And I was a presidential appointee of Bill Clinton.
So you've seen a lot. What's your interpretation of what's going on with American politics that is leaving this gigantic problem you're describing unaddressed? Why?
Part of the problem is that we suffer from two afflictions in America, and it's not just in the public sector, it's the private sector. The first is nearsightedness or myopia. People are fascinated with today, this quarter, this year. The longest that anybody will look out, even in the federal government, is 5 years, maybe 10 years. Secondly, we have a problem with tunnel vision in that we want to look at one issue at a time without understanding how that issue fits in the bigger picture and understanding what our broader challenge is. The last challenge that we have here is the way we keep score does not provide a full and fair view of where we are and where we're headed, either from a budget standpoint or from a financial reporting standpoint, and both need to be changed.
If Americans really understood what they're facing, what they and their children are headed toward, do you think they'd have the gumption to step up and fix it, or is it Americans themselves sharing the blame here?
Well, I think Americans need to be more informed and involved with regard to where we are and where we're headed. I have always found that the American people are a lot brighter than people give them credit for, and if you give them the facts and you tell them the truth, they will get it, and they will empower, and in fact, in some circumstances, demand that their elected representatives take appropriate steps to deal with large and growing problems.
David Walker, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with the country's top fiscal watchdog, U.S. Comptroller General David Walker, about his profound alarm over the future of the U.S. economy and the country. And we will hear after the break pushback from a Bush administration veteran who says we're in pretty good shape. What do you think? Do you get the feeling between deficits in China and Social Security that the country is sleepwalking toward calamity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the country's top fiscal watchdog, U.S. Comptroller General David Walker, about his alarm over the future of the U.S. economy and the country. And we will hear pushback in just a moment from a Bush administration veteran who says it's not so bad. You can join us as well. What do you think? You've heard David Walker tonight. Could the United States become another basket case Argentina? Or is that just Chicken Little talking here, kind of doomsaying? Or do you see a new day dawning on the strength of Bush tax cuts and economic growth? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from Washington by David Walker, Comptroller General at the Government Accountability Office. He was appointed by Bill Clinton to a 15-year term in 1998. You heard him say he's been a Republican, a Democrat. He's now an independent since 1997. Now joining us from Chevy Chase, Maryland, Philip Swagel. He's former chief of staff at the Council of Economic Advisers under George W. Bush from 2002 until February of this year. He's currently a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. Philip Swagel, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Great. Thanks very much for having me.
I'm sure you've heard the alarms that David Walker is raising. He's not the only one. You've even got conservatives raising alarms these days, saying that we are on a disastrous course here, that the tax cuts under the Bush administration have made the hole only deeper, and that things are not getting better. Are you equally alarmed?
I am in the long term. I mean, the long-term situation is very alarming. There's a great chart on the GAO website that really tells what I think is the entire story, and Mr. Walker focused a lot on that, and that shows entitlement spending is going up from about 8% of GDP now to close to 25% in 2080. Now, the president's tax cuts are equal to about 2% of GDP, and we have entitlement spending going up by 17 percentage points. So talking about the Bush tax cuts making the long-term deficit situation worse, well, that's true, but we're talking 2 out of 17. The real bottom line is that the forest is entitlement spending, and the trees is the short-term situation. And the reason I'm hopeful is that we do have a president who's really focused on entitlement reform. Now, he's starting with Social Security. He's working hard to reform Social Security to help boost national saving and to improve retirement security, and that's hopeful. Now, it's a hard fight, and there's lots of people opposed to making progress on entitlement reform, but at least we're trying.
Philip Swagel, we take your point. Everyone's talking about the long-term picture as the really scary one here. But before we leap too quickly to that and put the tax cuts aside and the budgets of these last few years, are you saying those were screw-ups but they don't really matter because they're so much smaller than the big wave coming? Or are you saying that the budget deficits we've seen under George Bush, the deficit spending and the tax cuts were the right thing?
Well, you know, no one likes deficits, but you have to think about where the economy has been and where it is now. You know, that it's a textbook prescription for economic weakness, right? The economy in around the middle of 2000 started plunging down. Industrial production, factory output started plunging early in the year. The stock market peaked and started going down. The Fed jumped in there with monetary easing, and fiscal policy then responded as well. So it's true. We've had deficits, and the tax cuts certainly contributed to that. But that's what we do when there's a weak economy, right? The point of government is not to do the best thing for the government. It's to do the best thing for the American people.
Well, to a point, David Walker was saying earlier that we're too many years into a recovery to still be having these big deficits. Of course, we heard Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican, writing a couple of years ago now. He wrote, "Republicans used to believe in balanced budgets. We have lost our way." As you're a Republican, you work for George W. Bush. Do you sympathize with Senator Hagel's view?
Absolutely. I think Senator Hagel is right on. And Mr. Walker, I fully agree with him as well, that we've seen spending ramp up very quickly. I have a colleague at AEI who's really done a lot of work on this, showing how spending has grown very quickly. And we do. We have a structural budget deficit that we're going to have to address. And I think the best way to address it, to have a strong economy in the future, is by spending restraint. Spending restraint where we can, but then we have to tackle entitlement spending, because that's really where the action is.
Philip Schlegel, stand by. David Walker, I wish you'd address Philip's sort of first at-bat here. He goes right away to the long-term picture. You're very focused there yourself, but what about the shorter term, the performance we've seen in these 4.5 years now of the George W. Bush administration? Can we put those aside as peanuts compared to the big problem and say they don't matter? How do you look at those, David Walker?
Well, they do matter, but I think what we need to do is to recognize that our big challenge is our long-range fiscal imbalance, and that has gotten worse, and it's closer to becoming a reality. We need budget controls reimposed. We need spending caps. We need pay-go rules on both sides of the ledger. If you're trying to control the bottom line, you can't exempt one side of the ledger, not just on the spending side, but also on the tax side. And Philip is right in saying that we have to have entitlement reform. It is absolutely essential. But in addition to that, we need to look at the base of discretionary mandatory spending and the base of tax policy, including tax preferences and how we're raising revenues. All three ultimately going to have to be addressed: entitlement reform, spending, and tax policy, because the gap is simply too great to rely upon one, and it's too great to grow our way out of.
And what about the tax cuts that President Bush brought? A, do you think they helped the economy, therefore they helped the budget situation? And B, he wants to extend them. Does that make sense in the context of what we're facing long term?
There's no question that they helped. The debate is whether or not they overcorrected, whether or not they were larger than they needed to be, and whether or not they ought to be made permanent. When I testified before the Congress back in early 2002, I reminded the Congress that we had temporary projected surpluses, and that one had to be prudent about what you did, both on the tax side and the spending side, in order to make sure that we didn't overcorrect. I noted that the lowest risk thing that you can do, or the least risk, was to pay down debt. The highest risk was to increase entitlement spending. I note that last year we increased entitlement spending by $8.1 trillion. Fundamentally imprudent.
This is with the pharmaceutical promises.
That's correct.
For elders, for seniors.
$8.1 trillion on a current dollar value basis, how much you'd have to have today invested at Treasury rates, is more than the entire debt outstanding of the United States since the beginning of the Republic.
Philip Schlegel, this is kind of on your hook at the Council of Economic Advisors. Were you in there, beating the drum against these steps, or did you think that the tax cuts in their size, in their scale, and the $8.1 trillion committed on pharmaceuticals somehow were good ideas?
Well, I think there's a certain irony that, my sense is that most people's complaints on the Democratic side in particular is that the Medicare bill wasn't generous enough, that, you know, there's this donut hole in the benefits, and lots of people wanted that to go away, which would make the benefit more costly and more expensive. So, I'm pretty sympathetic to people who complain that the Medicare bill was too expensive, right? The cost of the Medicare bill by itself is enough to save Social Security forever. So now, right, it modernizes Medicare, but it's very expensive. You know, on the other hand, the president was fighting for reform. The administration was fighting for reform.
For reform or re-election? I mean, were you saying from the Council of Economic Advisors, you can't do that, no matter what the Democrats say? They're not responsible either here.
Well, you know, there's different priorities, right? We had a Medicare system that was out of date, right, that didn't provide coverage for pharmaceuticals. Mm. And you can say, you know, there's different priorities, right? We have poor elderly who cannot afford pharmaceuticals. And the president said, look, it's important to let people have access to medicine. Everyone knows about the long-term entitlement situation and the long-term spending situation. He said, look, we can do this now. It's important to get this help going. And everyone understands we have to face up to the long-term fiscal situation. And that's, you know, that's not something just the economists in the administration were saying. Everyone understands that.
Phil Swagel, you know Vice President Cheney famously said, deficits don't matter.
Just a note, that Ron Susskind wrote that. No one's confirmed that the vice president said that.
Oh, do you think he believes otherwise? Or isn't there a school of thought that says, come on, it morning in America will come back. Well, let's just ride the deficits. And if we play this right, the economy is going to come roaring back and save our hinders here.
No, there's no economy strong enough to resolve our long-term fiscal situation. There's no economy strong enough to save Social Security. We have to take action to do both. And everyone believes that from the very top to the very bottom of the White House.
David Walker, Ron Susskind quoted the vice president there. Phil Swagel says he doesn't think that's what the vice president says. Have you seen that attitude in action in Washington, that deficits don't matter, that growth will solve our problem?
I've seen too much myopia. If the vice president said that, and I don't know if he did or not, I've seen that quote used in more than one publication. I think he was talking about politically, and that's one of my concerns. We need to do what's right for this country. We need to do what's right for the future of this country, our children and our grandchildren. And that means that we need to not overly focus on the short term. We need to recognize our large and growing long-term problem and start doing something about it. Philip mentioned about the fact that Medicare needed to be modernized. The problem is that Congress agreed conceptually that it was going to spend $395 billion on Medicare over 10 years when we had a surplus. The surplus is gone. And yet we still spent the money. And in addition, what ended up happening was that we layered on top of a 1965 Medicare program, which was based on Blue Cross Blue Shield in 1965. We didn't reform Medicare. We layered on top of Medicare. That is unacceptable. And it has got to change. And it's typical of what government does. It adds on, rather than fundamentally reexamining, reengineering. And modernizing things for the 21st century.
We've got a lot of citizens of this country who want to join the conversation. I want to turn to them. Tim is calling from Scituate, Massachusetts. Hi, Tim, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, my background is as a CPA.
Okay.
Mostly with small businesses.
Yep.
I started practice in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen up cycles, I've seen down cycles, I've seen high interest rates, low interest rates. What concerns me here is that we've been going through a prolonged boom period, you know, if you exclude the bubble burst on the high techs, but we've gone through a long boom period. We've dug ourselves deeper in the hole. We've enjoyed the lowest interest rates that
as low as they can get. Yeah.
And what's going to happen when those interest rates go up, as they inevitably will? Are we going to have any money left over out of our operating budget, our tax collections, to pay government expenses, or is debt service going to consume us all?
It's a straight-ahead CPA citizen question. It sounds like you have an answer yourself, Tim.
Well, it just seems to me the federal government's living on its credit cards, quite frankly.
And what happens when the interest rate on those cards goes up? Tim, thanks for calling. David Walker, what about that?
The fastest-growing future expense for the federal government is likely to be interest on the federal debt. It is a real problem. We're adding debt at or near record rates. Interest rates are near an all-time low, and it's only a matter of when and how much interest rates are going to go up, not a matter if they're going to go up.
And when they go up, what does it mean for what the government's paying out every year? Tim says, is it going to eat up the entire budget?
Well, the government is not leading by example with regard to fiscal matters. We are spending over $500 billion a year, even this year, more than we're going to take in with regard to our on-budget activity. given the fact that we're spending all the Social Security surplus as well. So we're clearly not leading by example. And frankly, if you see what's happening in the economy right now, we're not only adding debt at record rates at the federal level, individuals are also leveraging themselves up. And so, therefore, they're at increased risk. And our savings, both individual as well as in the aggregate, we have the lowest savings rate of any industrialized nation in the world. And one ultimately will pay a price for that if you don't correct it.
Mm-hmm. Philip Swagel, David Walker's talking about if these things don't get fixed, it's hard to imagine that somehow they won't be addressed. But let's say we get to 2040. He's saying you might have a situation where the federal government has to cut its budget spending by 60% or raise taxes by 250%. Does that sound like the kind of medicine this country may face one day if it doesn't get its house in order, Phil?
Yeah, absolutely. If we don't get our house in order, we're going to have a very difficult situation, and everyone knows that. And Mr. Walker is exactly right that we've done the political easy things up front. Now, again, we have a president who's working on something that's incredibly hard. He's working on Social Security. Everyone who's concerned about this conversation should be pushing hard for Social Security reform. You might not like the president's plan. That's fine. But somehow we have to start raising our national savings, and Social Security is a good place to start. Only one side in this discussion has any plan at all.
David Walker, what about that? The Democrats stonewalled President Bush on this. They said it's the wrong idea. They don't want privatized accounts here. The president's still out there beating the drum for it. What do you think of his solution?
Well, I believe that we clearly have to have entitlement reform, not just Social Security, but Medicare. I used to be a trustee of Social Security and Medicare from 1990 to 1995. President George Herbert Walker Bush appointed me to that position. I think the president should be commended for recognizing the need for entitlement reform and for going out front and taking the political risk to reform Social Security. My personal view is that way too much time and attention has been focused on individual accounts, and that people still don't understand that Social Security is only about 8 to 9% of our long-range imbalance. Now, don't get me wrong. Better to reform it now rather than later because it'd be a good down payment. It would help increase confidence that we can deal with tougher issues, and it would improve our credibility of our ability to deal with problems before we reach crisis proportions.
I thought it was a bigger monster than that in the woodpile here, but not 8 to 9% of the overall problem? That's all Social Security represents?
We've got an unfunded obligation, or a gap, if you will, fiscal gap in current dollar terms of about $45.6 trillion. Mm. Social Security represents about $4 trillion of that. Medicare represents close to $30.
Whoa, so health care, Medicare, really the big monster here. But what about Bush's plan? The Democrats have said, no, it doesn't. We don't need it, and it won't really address the problem, and it's going to spend too much money in the short term on financing private accounts. What about the criticism, David Walker?
The fact of the matter is that individual accounts may be part of a comprehensive solution. There are pros and cons to individual accounts. I've been on two Social Security Reform Commissions myself, you know, prior to my current position. They both included individual accounts as an element of reform, but you need to make other reforms in order to assure the solvency and sustainability of the system in order to be able to not only make it work, but gain enough political support to pass it.
Vince is calling from Greenville, North Carolina. Hi, Vince. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I have lost 4 jobs already because of companies closing up and the work going all overseas, and yep. I'm listening to the broadcast tonight with Philip, and boy, everything he's saying is right on. And I just wonder if he's got enough clout to actually influence the change. I have talked to I'm in my mid-50s, mm-hmm. and I have talked to dozens of people who like me, are looking at what's going on in our society, and they said it just cannot continue and continue and continue. $40,000 and $50,000 vehicles, huge amounts. People I know at the bank telling me of huge amounts of credit card debt. But our government also, as was mentioned tonight, is not setting the standard for how this should be. We cannot continue to throw money at this stuff. Take the money away. Don't feed it.
So Vince, where's the political will to change this? If it's that clear to you and to other Americans, why haven't people stood up and said, we want a government that's going to actually address this? We'll take the medicine.
We don't have a connection. There's no connection today. The government is setting the standard and saying we can spend billions and billions and we can just go on ahead. We can be the police chiefs of the world. We can build up a military strength and presence to protect the entire world, yet 9/11 was pretty much evidence that we don't have genuinely that ability, but we keep throwing money at it. And the solution to the to financial problems is not to increase the financial resources. The solutions are to be creative with what you have and learn how to adjust accordingly.
Vince,
we have a society today that cannot adapt to doing without.
And yet we may have to. And if we don't do a little bit of that soon, we may have to do a whole lot of it later, we're hearing tonight. Vince, thanks for your call. We'll come back and look at those issues. We're joined tonight by David Walker, Comptroller General at the Government Accountability Office, and by Philip Swagel, former Chief of Staff at the Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush. You can join us as well. Were the tax cuts crazy or critical to spurring the economy? Could America stomach the medicine David Walker is describing? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the country's top fiscal watchdog, U.S. Comptroller General David Walker, about his profound alarm over the future of the U.S. economy and the country. We're also joined tonight by Philip Swagel, former Chief of Staff at the Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush from 2002 until February of this year, currently a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank in Washington. You can join us tonight. What do you think? Is it time for emergency action? Like what? And are we talking about the end of the world as we know it here, the collapse of the economy of the republic, David Walker suggests at one point? Or is that doomsaying? Is the U.S. too strong to fail? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jim is calling from North Bergen, New Jersey. Hi, Jim. You're on the air. What do you think, my friend?
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I had sent you a little anecdote on the email. I was living in India at one time when we were outsourcing our programming there, and I got outsourced as well. The Russian Empire expanded itself out of existence. The British Empire fought itself out of existence, and the Americans are going to spend themselves out of existence. And I think it's right on target. It's like a joke among Indian people, but we just can't sustain these levels of spending, and I don't see any way to do it. And the tax reforms that have been pushed through since Reagan, you did at one time have a tax bracket for very extraordinarily wealthy people that was up around 70%, and that's gone. And now they're talking about the death tax, which even Bill W. Gates Sr., who manages the Bill Gates Trust Fund,
right,
was on NPR on someone's show, I think Brian Lehrer, and he said he's absolutely against that because it would gut any reason for people to donate money in their estates.
That is getting rid of the estate tax, yeah.
Right, yeah, the estate tax, because the way it's being structured now, you'd have to have an estate that's worth $20-30 million, say you had 3 or 4 heirs.
So you're saying let the rich help pay off some of this debt, you're saying, Jim?
A rather enormous estate before it's going to get taxed.
Yep.
So there's an enormous source of revenue. And also the last tax cut that went through, the substantial part of it went to the very high end. So we're pushing this country in a situation where we're squeezing out the middle class. And, you know, it's just not a healthy thing. We can't maintain this. Even Vladimir Putin made a statement that by, I think it's the World Bank or the IMF's standards, the ones the U.S. sets, since the U.S. owes almost 20% of its, well, more than 20% of its GDP in debt, it should be considered a debtor nation and unfit for favorable lending rates.
Except that everybody has to lend because the whole world economy depends on it. Jim, we got it. We thank you for your call. David Walker, a couple things there. One, the criticism that there's been too many favors given to the wealthy at the expense of solving bigger problems. Do you see that as an issue, and how big an issue in the overall picture?
Well, obviously there's going to be a continued debate about, first, how much revenue should we have be How do we raise that revenue? To what extent should it be a payroll tax, an income tax, or a consumption tax? And then thirdly, how to allocate that burden among those who have more, who make more money and have more assets versus those who don't? That's what elected representatives have to deal with. What I care about is, in the final analysis, you've got to be able to generate enough revenues to deliver on your commitments and to deliver on your promises. And so we need to, again, reform entitlement programs. We need to really look at the base of spending because we're on an unsustainable path outside of entitlement programs. And we're going to need to look at tax policy. How much money do we need to raise? How best to raise it? Clearly, it's going to have to be somewhat of a progressive situation where those who have more will pay more. But I think we need to think about whether or not we ought to be going more towards a consumption tax rather than trying to build upon old models based upon old economies.
Phil Zweigle, how about it? Discretionary spending up 23% in George Bush's first term. Taxes on the wealthy down considerably. Do you think the pendulum swung too far in that direction? Do the wealthy need to be paying more?
Well, you know, it's funny. The wealthy are paying more, right? The share of taxes borne by the top 20% has gone up over the first term of the president's.
Well, there's more and there's more. Our deficit has grown as well,
I'm just saying that the fact is wrong, right? It's easy to say the rich are getting everything, but the fact is that in 2001 the top 20% paid 64% of all taxes, not just income taxes but wage taxes also. And now the top 20% pays 64.6%. It's a small increase. So the tax policy of the administration has both spurred growth, but it's also actually increased the progressivity of the system by some measures. There are other measures of progressivity that show the opposite result. But by some measures, the tax policy.
We've got the balance right, that the burden is being spread in the optimal manner across all levels of income. Wealth.
I mean, there's always ways to change the system to make it better, to make it more fair. And, we have a tax panel that's working on it right now. And, I want to second, actually, what Mr. Walker said about having a tax code that doesn't penalize saving in the way that our tax code does now.
I see where you're coming down there. David Walker, I want to begin to look at solutions here. You've talked about some of what's needed, but kind of lay out, stations of the cross that you imagine we might follow to fix this rather than heading into some horrid future.
Well, several things. One, first, we have to change how we keep score, both for budget purposes as well as how we're reflecting the current projected financial condition of the United States. Neither one at the present time provides a full and fair view about where we are and where we're headed. Secondly, we need to reestablish serious budget controls. We need to have spending targets. We need to have triggers that will require congressional action on mandatory spending as well as entitlement programs when they're hit. We need to be able to make sure that we've got pay-as-you-go rules for new legislation, both on the spending side and the tax side. We need to reform entitlement programs.
What does that mean? How much would Social Security and Medicare have to be cut?
That means Medicare. That means Medicaid.
What scale of cuts? How do you do that?
Well, we could spend a whole program on that. I think, for one thing, let's take Social Security, which ought to be a win-win. We can reform Social Security and make sure that every generation gets more than they expect they're going to get. Not more than they've been promised. More than they expect they're going to get, and make it solvent and secure for current and future generations if we approach it the right way. And
that means cuts in what's currently projected.
No, here's what it means. Mm-hmm. Here's what it means. What it means is you take people who are currently retired or nearing retirement, you deliver on the promise. You do it because they're the ones that are most fearful of getting a cut, and they're the ones who don't have time to make adjustments. You take baby boomers, Generation X, Generation Y, etc. You make gradually greater increases, gradually greater changes in the program the younger the person is, on retirement ages, on replacement rates, on indexing formulas. You can do it with or without individual accounts, and every generation will get more than they think they're going to get. I call that a huge win.
Does that mean an end to Social Security, an end to
the notion that you'd be protected
from poverty in old age?
Frankly, there are reform proposals out there right now, including some that I've been involved with in the past, that even include individual accounts that provide an enhanced defined benefit to keep people out of poverty for lower-income individuals. And so, but it's important to keep in mind that you can do this with or without individual accounts, but if you have individual accounts, they have to be an element of a comprehensive solution. By themselves, they just won't get the job done.
And what about the health care costs? You're talking about a $30 billion deficit, trillion-dollar deficit looming in Medicare. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think we have to recognize that ultimately we're going to have to reform our entire health care system. It is not going to be a government-run system. But we're going to have to reform the entire system, because if there's one thing that threatens our long-term competitive advantage and our both federal and state fiscal posture, it's health care. It's out of control.
Does it mean less health care for Americans? Does it mean less health for Americans, or something else?
I think over the years, what we're going to have to do is the following. We're going to have to say, what is the basic and essential type of health services, and I pick those two words carefully, that every American, no matter what your age is, no matter what your income level is, no matter where you are, that we need to make sure of a society that everybody has. That's a lot less than many people have right now, but it's more than 45 million people have. We need to focus on making sure that everybody has that and then provide options and choice mechanisms for people to get more if they want, but they're going to have to come out of their pocket. Because we've got a situation right now where we're not meeting the needs of many, and we're way into unaffordable wants for a lot.
Phil Swagel, we've just got a minute left here. You're out of the Bush administration now. George Bush isn't running again. If you could suggest a course correction to the president, what would it be?
No, I mean, I do the opposite. I'd say keep fighting for Social Security reform. That's vital, and then move on to health care and take on the challenge of health care, like Mr. Walker said. I mean, the Social Security steps that he described are basically what the president's asking for. He wants, upper-class Americans to bear the burden of the lower benefits that we have to face.
So steady as she goes. David Walker, steady as she goes?
We need to mend our ways. We need to recognize reality that we are on a large we have a large and growing structural deficit. We are on an imprudent path, and we are not making enough progress, and we need to do it soon. Look, I'm not concerned about myself and my generation. I'm very concerned about my country. I'm very concerned about my two children, and I'm very concerned about my two grandchildren.
There's the time frame we're looking at tonight, and there's the scale of the challenge. You've laid it out vividly. Philip Swagel, former Chief of Staff, Council of Economic Advisors, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Great, thank you.
And David Walker, I can't tell you how grateful we are to you, the way you're beating the drum and raising this. What do you think the chances are of a real change in political climate in Washington to make this come?
The good news is people are starting to pay attention. America has had much greater challenges in the past. We will deal with this. We just need to do it sooner rather than later.
David Walker, Comptroller General at the Government Accountability Office. Mr. Walker, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
In a moment, a mother prepares for her son's second deployment to Iraq. This is On Point. When San Diego writer Sue Diaz's son, Roman, returned from more than a year of service in Iraq last summer, his mother breathed a huge sigh of relief. Now, 1 year later, Roman, a specialist in the U.S. Army, is heading back to Iraq for a second 15-month tour of duty. The past 12 months have been an emotional roller coaster for his mother, Sue. In tonight's radio diary, she tells the story of her son's recent visit home, his last trip home before his second deployment to Iraq.
Whatever it is, let's be cool about it. We can act like we don't even notice, I suggested. My husband and I were on our way to the airport to pick up our 21-year-old son, Roman, an infantryman with the 101st Airborne in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Roman was coming home to San Diego for 10 days before heading back to Iraq to begin his second 15-month deployment there. In a call shortly before we left for the airport, his older sister, whom he just visited in the Bay Area, told us we were in for a surprise. The only clue Ann offered was that it had something to do with her brother's hair. Now, Mom, just keep in mind where he's been and what he's going back to. Who can blame him right now if he just wants to have a little fun? New color, I guessed. You'll see, was all she'd say. Roman's height alone, 6 feet, 2 inches, would have made him easy to spot, standing there near the curb in front of the terminal. But his hair made him impossible to miss. There's something head-turning about a mohawk, even when it stands no more than an inch and a half high, especially a bright red one with the tips dyed black. Oh, his computer engineer dad gulped, catching sight of him. Oh, my, I elaborated. But after a curbside flurry of car doors opening and a couple quick hugs, to Roman we simply said with all the nonchalance we could muster, "Welcome home," and "Good to see you." On the drive back, I turned from time to time in the front bucket seat to ask him about his flight from San Jose, his weekend with his sister. His dad chatted offhandedly about the weather, asked about the soldiers in the unit he now leads. My Jedi, Roman calls them. But there was an elephant in the room. 20 minutes into the trip, I could ignore it no longer. I said, twisting to look at Roman full on. I can't quite put my finger on it, but something's definitely different. What could it be? He teased, fingertip touching one corner of his smile. Roman's always had an independent streak, and as far as surprises go, this one was small compared with his decision 3 years ago to join the Army instead of going to college. It's taken me nearly this long to come to terms with that choice, and I think I have, as much as any mother can in times like these. In fact, just a few days earlier, I'd given friends and neighbors a flyer announcing our soldiers' brief visit home and inviting them to come say hi at a block party barbecue on Sunday in the cul-de-sac, the same place Roman learned to ride a two-wheeler. Don't worry, Mom, I'm going to shave it off at the end of this leave. I'll have to, he said. It's just that I've always wanted to do something crazy with my hair, and I figured this was my last chance. I trust he was looking ahead to his role someday as a responsible post-Army adult. But like the dark smoke of a roadside bomb, the idea of lasts inevitably hovers over a leave like this one, colors it in ways Clairol never thought of. Anyone with someone they love heading into harm's way knows this. War has a way of making clear what really matters in this life. To their credit and his, the 60 or so neighbors who came to the block party seemed to take Roman's hair in stride. It was a vindication of sorts, if any was even needed. Men clapped him on the back and laughed. Kids said, "Cool." Moms wrapped their arms around him. In spite of differing views about the war, everyone there wished our unconventional soldier well. I must confess, I still thought this new, albeit temporary, look of his was not the most mature thing my son's ever done. And then he surprised me again with something that was. It came in answer to a question I asked the day before he left. We'd been talking about how time flies, how the end date of his 4-year stint in the service will come up while he still has 3 months left in Iraq. "Well then, think the Army might let you come back sooner?" I asked. "You know, before the rest of your unit?" Roman gave me a look that said he couldn't believe I was asking that. "Mom, even if the Army would, I couldn't do that. Say to my men, 'See ya, I'm out of here.' No way. No. I'll come home when they do." Remember these stories, the funny hair, the serious conversation, the next time you see a dusty group of U.S. soldiers in the news. Think about the unique individuals who wear those look-alike uniforms, their goodness and goofiness, their complexity and their courage. Think about all we as a country lose when even one of them falls.
Sue Diaz is a regular contributor to On Point and the Christian Science Monitor. She lives in San Diego, California. Her son, Roman, is expected to return to action in Iraq at the end of next month. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.